To remind you once again, if you're interested in participating in the citywide food drive on Saturday, May the 3rd, please fill out one of these little forms that are on the table in the foyer and hand it to myself or slip it under Bob's door, just so that we have a good head count of who is going to be participating in that, so that we don't bite off more than we can chew when we tell the people assigning neighborhoods how much we're going to cover. So if you want to be part of that, please fill out a form. If you're not sure what that's all about, just come chat with me after service and I'll be happy to fill you in on what details I can. I'm not a morning person. I don't know how many of you are morning persons or evening persons, but I am not a morning person. I never have been, at least not since like grade 6, and I don't know that I ever will be. I've tried all sorts of different things that people have told me, oh, do this, do that, and it'll help you change your biological, I don't want to say biological clock, but it will change your sleeping rhythm so that you'll be used to getting up early in the morning and whatever, and then none of those things have ever really worked for me. And no matter what I do, I still seem to be a night person, not a morning person. And most of my days actually require me to get up a lot earlier than I would like. But I do it, and I'm sluggish, and I'm tired. When I get up in the morning, I'm usually sleepy and dopey and grumpy, maybe a little bit bashful, definitely not happy, or sneezy or doc either. But that's the way I am in the morning. And at nights, usually I am just wide awake, despite how tired I've been all day long, and despite how much or how little caffeine I've consumed during the day. Around 9 or 10 o'clock, all of a sudden I'm just wide awake and energized and ready to go. All of which combines to make mornings really difficult for me. Not yesterday, but the week before that, on Saturday morning, Michelle got up with the kids in the morning and I slept a little later. And when I got up, I told her that I had intended to get up when the kids got up in the morning and let her sleep in a little longer. And she looked at me rather skeptically and said, well, this morning, Harrison came into our room, and as he normally does, he came up to you and he said, is it morning yet? And you said, yes, and he went out to the living room. And then you went back to snoring. And so I figured, you're not getting up, so I got up and took care of him. And I looked at her and I said, in all honesty, I don't remember any of that. And that's how I am in the morning. Michelle's alarm clock goes off every morning, and not one single morning do I ever hear that thing beeping. And I have learned the hard way that the snooze button on your alarm clock can be a very dangerous thing. I know from first-hand experience that most snooze buttons are set to ring the alarm off after 9 more minutes. And I have had all the ones I have used, and in the past, I have figured out that they will typically give up ringing the alarm after maybe a dozen times of hitting the snooze button. If you go long enough, the snooze will finally say, that's it, this guy's not getting up, we're not going to bother anymore. I've learned that. And I've hit the snooze so many times that sometimes, like responding to Harrison's early morning inquiry, I can reach over and I can smack the alarm clock either close enough or hard enough to the snooze button that I buy myself that extra 9 minutes of sleep without ever waking up enough to even realize that I've done it. Well, that's very much like what our parable today is all about. God sends us warnings and he sends us reminders all the time. He gives us gentle nudges in the right direction. He gives us some more direct instructions about what he desires. He gives us reminders all the time of the mission that he has given us, of the tasks that he has assigned us, of the work that he wants us to accomplish with the resources he has entrusted to us. God puts these alarm clocks, if you will, in our daily lives so that we don't forget the business that we are supposed to be about. But like any alarm clock, if it gets ignored enough times, it will eventually lose all of its effectiveness. I don't notice this so much here, but I remember when we lived in Vancouver, Lots of people had car alarms on their vehicles. And because of that, it seemed like you couldn't go a day without hearing a whole bunch of different car alarms going off everywhere you went. They were going off all the time. And it happened so frequently that when a car alarm went off, you could just stand there and observe. A car alarm would go off and not one person would even turn and look to see where the noise was coming from, because they're just so used to the alarms going off all the time. Well, in Luke chapter 15 and chapter 16, Jesus is talking to people who have become immune to the alarms. They've become blind to the warning signs. They have gotten comfortable with the way that things are. He is talking to people who will hear these stories and think to themselves, well, you know what? Losing one sheep out of 100 isn't a big deal because you still got 99 more at home. People who will think, you know what, it's really not worth turning the house upside down in the middle of the night to find one coin if you've got nine more in your hand. And the people who will think, you know what, that kid made his own decision and now he has to live with the consequences of it. Really what we have in this section of text in Luke's gospel is a trilogy of stories. It begins with the lost sheep and works its way deeper and deeper until it gets to our text for today in Luke chapter 16. Each story is a little more powerful, a little more direct, a little tougher for us to swallow. It starts in Luke chapter 15. And really these three parables in Luke chapter 15, a lot of people say we should really just look at those as kind of combine them into one parable. One parable with maybe three acts in it, if you would. And each telling kind of ups the stakes a little bit. The lost sheep, we see that 1 out of 100 is missing. In the lost coin, 1 out of 10 goes missing. In the lost son, 1 out of 2 sons goes missing. And so the first two stories of this section are really just to kind of prime you and prepare you for what's going to happen in the third one. They're to make you ready so that when the harder context comes in the third story, you are already prepared to embrace the idea that's going to come. And so they set up these first two stories so that by the time Jesus gets to the third story and he begins by saying there was a young man who asked his father for his inheritance early, the audience already knew what was going to come next. They knew he was going to get lost, he was going to get found, and there was going to be a party. They already knew what was coming because they had heard the first two stories, and sure enough, that's exactly what happens. So if we combine those all together and begin with the story of the prodigal son, what we see, we see this pattern emerging through and a similar plot through the next couple stories that we looked at. There was a person who was given something, and that person rather quickly seems to waste what they were given. The son wastes his father's possessions. The manager we talked about last week wastes his master's possessions. And this week we're going to talk about a rich man who wastes his own possessions. And in the first two stories, they end with where the character seeks redemption and redemption is found. But in the third story that we're going to look at today, redemption isn't even sought after. Now, there are a couple things you need to know before we get into our parable for this morning. The first thing you need to know about this story is that it is a story. It is a fictional account. It's not a historical record or a true event. Jesus is not telling this story to give us a detailed description of how the afterlife works. This is simply an analogy to illustrate a general truth. Something like this. If I were to tell you, once upon a time there was a woman, and this woman was fairly poor, but what she had she was very generous with. And she was very caring to others, and whenever she could help out people, she would do so. And she was also very devoted to prayer and going to church and worshiping God. At the same time, there was a man, and this man was very successful. He was very wealthy, he was very well-to-do. And this man achieved many great things in life. And he used much of what he had to enjoy the benefits of his work, because after all, he had earned these things. And although this man wasn't a terribly bad man, he wasn't very philanthropic either. And he'd go to church sometimes, but he was never really dedicated to worship and reading his Bible and prayer and those things. And it came to pass that both these people died, and they went up to heaven. And at the pearly gates, Peter met them both there. And he said, "Welcome, we're glad to see you here. Let me show you to your accommodations." And Peter took them strolling through the streets of heaven, and they went through past all these houses, these big, gorgeous, beautiful houses. And it wasn't long before they stopped at one house, and it was massive, it was gorgeous, it was a mansion, it was everything that you could possibly want in a house. And the guy was very excited. He's like, "Hey, I could live here. This is even better than the place I had down on earth." But Peter said, "Oh, hang on a minute. This house is for this sweet old lady." And so the lady went into her house to enjoy her new surroundings. And Peter said, "Come with me. We need to go a little bit farther to get to your place." And so they walked on down the street a little further through town and further through town. And as they walked through town, the houses started to get a little smaller and a little simpler and a little smaller and a little simpler until they got to the very edge of town. And Peter stops by this house that is really not much more than a shack. It is simple, it is plain, it is small. And he says to the man, "Here is your house. Go and enjoy it." And the man says, "Well, I don't want to stay here. I want a big, big, nice house like that old lady got. Why can't I have a house like that?" And Peter replies to the man and he says, "Well, sir, we did the very best with the resources you sent up in advance, and this was all we could construct." Now, the purpose of that story is not to give you a detailed description of what heaven is like. It's not to tell you that, yes, there are pearly gates and Peter will be standing there to meet you. Peter is not the tour guide who's going to lead you through the streets of heaven, and not each one of us doesn't actually receive a physical structured house for us to live in for all eternity. The purpose of that story is to illustrate the general truth that what we do on this earth translates somehow into eternity. That as Jesus said, we should store up treasures for ourselves in heaven where they don't get destroyed and corrupted. That's the purpose of that story. And likewise, in this story, it is just there to illustrate a general truth. And so as we get into it, I'm asking you, at least for this morning, please try not to get hung up on the great chasm that divides the two sides in eternity, and what exactly Abraham's bosom is all about, and the fact that people in heaven can see and talk to people who are in hell. Try to overlook all of that stuff, because that's not what the story is about. Jesus is telling this story to illustrate a general truth. Second thing you need to realize about this story is that as Jesus begins to tell it, everyone in his audience has this certain perspective on life. And the perspective they have on life is that wealth in the ancient world was considered to be a sign of God's favor. And poverty was considered to be an evidence of sin. And so as Jesus begins this story by saying there was a rich man who had everything and there was a poor man who was covered with sores, immediately all the audience would assume that the rich man was a good and godly man and that the poor man must be a terrible sinner. And that would be their perception coming into their story. That's not an accurate view, but that's what people would be assuming. So, with all that in mind, let's begin and get into our story. We'll start with one short verse, but it's going to tell us a whole lot of things about the people in our story. First member of our cast in our story this morning is the rich man. Luke chapter 16, verse 19 says, "There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and lived in luxury every day." And unfortunately, the English version of this verse doesn't tell us nearly as much as the original text did. So we need to get a fuller picture here. First of all, this rich man, you may have heard him been called Dives, D-I-V-E-S. And that's the Latin word for rich. And so lots of times if you hear this story being talked about, they'll talk about this guy and they'll call him Dives. And what we know about him is that he was dressed in purple. And that means that his robes were extremely expensive. One commentator estimated the worth of his robes based on what was said in the text, and it basically translates out to, it would take 5 years of a working man's wage to pay for one of these robes. That's roughly the equivalent. I did the best I could. It's roughly the equivalent of the Kitten K50 suit, which is worth $50,000, I am told. And the Armani Privé dress worn by Kate Blanchett to the Oscars this year, which is apparently worth about $100,000. It's worth those two combined. Now, I don't see how either of those are actually worth that much, but you get an idea of the sense of the value that this guy was spending on his wardrobe. Some people say that this description is similar to what you would hear described of the robes that a high priest would wear. And this guy wore these things every day. This wasn't like some of us who have that one really good suit that we wear on special occasions. No, this is how this guy wore. This was his wardrobe for every day. And then Jesus adds in this little line, which doesn't mean much to us, but it says that he was dressed in fine linen. And if you look at the actual word that is used there, it means two things. First of all, it's talking about linen that is Egyptian cotton, which is like really, apparently really good, very valuable, good quality linen. And the second thing is the word that's used there is specifically used to identify undergarments. And so as Jesus is telling this story, he's talking about the opulence that this man lives in. He says he wears these great, wonderful purple robes, and even his underwear is expensive, is the image that he's trying to give to you of how this man has been using his money, how he is living, and how he is existing together. And so that's the picture we get. The phrase that says he lived in luxury, more specifically, that's talking, one commentator I read described it this way. He said it's talking about gourmet feeding on exotic and costly dishes. And so when it says he lived in luxury, it means he was feasting every day. These great and wonderful feasts every day. And so if he's doing it every day, that also means he's doing it on the Sabbath, which happens to put his servants in a very awkward position, because to prepare these feasts on the Sabbath would be against the rules of the Sabbath. But apparently that is not of issue to him, because he wants to have his great feast every day. Scholars tell us that regular people were lucky to eat meat once a week, and yet he is living in utter extravagance, both in quantity and quality, at all of his meals. The thing I can most liken it to is think of a buffet on a cruise ship. That's the kind of imagery you want to have of this guy as he's feasting every day in his home. Second character in our story is called Lazarus. Luke 16, starting in verse 20, describes him this way. At his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered with sores, longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. Now Lazarus is a unique fellow, because he is the only person in all of Jesus' parables to be given a name. We're not really sure why that is. Maybe Lazarus' name is, he's given a name in a symbolic way, kind of like Dives, because the name Lazarus means the one who God helps. I'm not sure why he is named specifically, but remember, bear in mind that he is not a real person. He's not a specific guy. He is not Mary and Martha's brother that you're going to read about in John chapter 11. It's not the same Lazarus. This is just a fictional guy. But he is special in some way, at least to Jesus, because he is given a special name. And the story tells us that he was laid out in front of the rich man's gate. And the term laid is a passive term, which means he was unable to get there himself, but his friends or his family must have picked him up and brought him and set him in front of the rich man's gate every day. And it's not uncommon. This is still what happens today, especially in the Middle East. On Sundays, the poor and the beggars and the invalids will be brought to church on Sunday morning, so that people coming out of church can care for them. And on Fridays at noon prayers, they will be taken to the mosque by people so that they can be helped out by the people who are coming out of the mosque on Friday noon. And so the people in the town have brought Lazarus and set him at the gate of the rich man, probably because the rich man was the only one in town who had the means to aid Lazarus. And so there Lazarus sat, and he sat there every day. It's unlikely that the rich man didn't notice him or didn't know that he was there, because he would be there every day. The rich man would have seen him. Lazarus is covered in sores, and so much so that his plight is that the dogs came along and licked his sores. And by the dogs licking his sores, that would make him an unclean person, because dogs were unclean animals in the Jewish culture. And so by the dogs licking him, he himself became unclean, which would mean people wouldn't want to touch him or have anything to do with him, because the uncleanness would be passed on to them. Story says that he longed to get the food that fell from the rich man's table. Back in those days, people would eat their food with their hands, with their fingers. They didn't have fancy utensils like we do today. And so they would eat with their hands and their fingers. And in the wealthy houses, they would have big chunks of bread, and they would use these chunks of bread to wipe their hands off, and then they would toss the bread onto the floor. And that's the kind of scraps that Lazarus is desiring after, that is wanting. I know on occasions we have gone to a restaurant, and you know, when you eat your meal and you don't actually finish all of your meal, and so you get it in a take-home box. And sometimes we have had our take-home box, especially if we're downtown or someplace, and we'll see someone who's obviously been living on the street, and so we'll share our leftovers with this man. But that's not really the sense that we're getting here, because what's happening here is they're scraping the stuff up off the floor, and that's the stuff that Lazarus desires to eat. It's the same term, desires to eat is the same idea as what is used in Luke 15 when it talks about the young son who was desiring to eat the slop that he was feeding to the pigs. It's the same kind of idea that Lazarus is wanting the scraps from this man's table. In Mark chapter 7, we have a story where a woman comes to Jesus, and she's a Greek woman, not an Israelite. And so she wants Jesus to heal her daughter. And because Jesus' ministry had been primarily to the Israelites, the question is asked, or the statement is given, that it's not right for the children's bread to be tossed to their dogs. And the woman replies that even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs, right? And so in the Israelites' world view, the Gentiles were considered to be dogs, and the Samaritans were considered to be worse than dogs. And that's the imagery that is going on when we see this poor guy laying outside the gate, wishing to eat the scraps from the table. And to add injury to insult, to pour salt in the wounds, the scraps are given to the dogs ahead of Lazarus. Now, the text says that even the dogs came and licked his wounds. And as we read that, we usually think that the dogs licking his wounds are adding insult to injury to where Lazarus was at. But that's not really exactly what's going on, because the word "even" in the original text is a word of contrast. And so therefore, what it's really saying, it's actually an insult to the rich man. That what it's actually saying is that the rich man was there, and Lazarus was out in front of the gate, and even the dogs took better care of Lazarus than the rich man did. My wife is always telling me, when some dog is slobbering all over her, that a dog's mouth is cleaner than a human's mouth. I don't know if that's true, but I've read that a dog's saliva contains endogenous peptide antibiotics, which are useful for healing. And so the dogs coming to lick Lazarus was actually a good thing. In 1994, a Harvard professor doing an archaeological dig near Ashkelon found a site that is dated between 500 and 300 BC. And in that site, they found the remains of 1,300 dogs carefully laid down, not injured at all, died of natural causes, had their tail neatly wrapped around their legs, so they were very well cared for. And the general consensus is that these dogs were part of a Phoenician healing cult. And so what you would do is if you had some injury or some sore, you would come to this place and you would pay to have the dog lick your wounds because there was some healing in the dog's saliva that would help you get better. In that time and place, dogs were not kept as pets. Dogs were considered to be unclean, much like pigs. And so Lazarus being licked by dogs is much like the prodigal son being out there feeding the pigs. And that also brings us a parallel to the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan, Samaritans were called worse than dogs. And as you remember the story of the Good Samaritan, the priest and the Levite walk by the man, but the Samaritan, who's worse than a dog, stops and tends to the man's wounds. Most likely these dogs belonged to the rich man. They were the guard dogs that were getting the scraps off his table. And Lazarus was obviously there often enough that the dogs recognized him, were friendly with him, and so they licked his wounds instead of biting him, quite possibly from the other side of the gates, because the dogs would have been kept on the inside and Lazarus most certainly would have been left on the outside. And so a time comes when both of these men die or are taken into the afterlife. And first Lazarus says he is taken up and he is put in a place that's kind of hard for us to understand. The term Abraham's side is a little ambiguous to us. The term Abraham's bosom is a little awkward for us to kind of process. But usually the picture we get is something like this picture with Abraham kind of holding Lazarus in the afterlife. Well, to maybe give some clarity to it, that term of being at someone's bosom that's used here of Abraham and Lazarus, it's the same term that's used if you have an older version like a KJV, a King James, is used at the Last Supper. And it will say that the disciple that Jesus loved was leaning on Jesus' bosom. And that's the same kind of picture. And it comes from the way that they would eat. And they would sit at a circular or a U-shaped table. And the host or the most important person would sit at the middle. And then people would kind of sit and lean against him. And so the person who was at the host's bosom is the person who was at his right side, was at the place of honor at the table. And so the image that really Jesus is giving in this picture is that Lazarus goes into the afterlife and Abraham is there and he welcomes him in and he essentially is having a celebration and Lazarus is the guest of honor at this celebration. Which reminds us, of course, of Luke 15 where everyone who is found is celebrated with a party. Then there's a rich man. He finds himself in a place of torment. And this is where this story diverges from the two previous, because the rich man never comes to his senses like the prodigal did. He never has that moment of clarity. He never sees the writing on the wall. He never gets up and heads home to the Father. You see, the rich man's view of Lazarus, even in the afterlife, has not changed. Neither has his view of himself. And when he begins to speak, he doesn't actually address Lazarus, he addresses Abraham and asks Abraham to command Lazarus to come down and bring him some water. You see, Lazarus' pain was ignored, but now that the shoe is on the other foot, something must be done. Stat, ASAP, and whatever other acronyms you can come up with. Instead of apologizing to Lazarus, he demands services. He essentially calls out and says, now that Lazarus is feeling a little better and is back on his feet, I wouldn't mind a few services, if you please, given who I am and given that he, being of the servant class, such service is naturally to be expected. So send him down, Abraham, and tell him to be quick about it. Unlike Lazarus, I am not accustomed to such discomfort. And Abraham replies to the rich man. And in your text, it probably says son, but the more literal translation of the word would be, my dear boy. And it's the exact same term that the father uses when he talks to the older son who refuses to come to the party when the younger son comes home. He says, my dear boy. That's not the way it works. That can't happen.
And he even says, there's a big chasm between the two of us, and he says that those who want to go from here to you cannot do it, which makes me wonder who in their right mind would want to go from where Abraham was to where the rich man was. And some infer from that that perhaps Lazarus himself was willing to cross over and assist the rich man, which makes the contrast between these two guys that much more dramatic. And when the rich man realizes that Abraham is not going to send Lazarus to help him, he says, "Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my brothers to warn them." And here is the ironic part of the story, because the rich man is now begging, and the beggar is now feasting. But the rich man is still giving orders. He says, "Send Lazarus to do this." And Abraham says, "That just won't work." And when the real Lazarus came back from the dead, the Pharisees and the Jewish leaders didn't listen to him either. Instead, they started plotting Jesus' death. And Luke's readers are being challenged to believe in Christ who came back from the dead. And some of his readers will, but for many, even a messenger come back from the grave will not be enough to persuade them. In the movie Lord of the Rings, there's a scene where Gandalf and Frodo are having a conversation. And Frodo, who is the little guy who's been given a great responsibility to carry, he's talking to Gandalf and says, "You know what? I don't like how all this is going. I don't like how all this is happening. I wish that none of this had happened." And Gandalf responds by saying, "So do all who live to see such time. But that's not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that has been given us." And that is very similar to the message of this parable. The message of this parable is that it matters. What matters most is not what we have or do not have. What matters most is what we do with the things we have. What we do with the good and with the bad that this life gives us. It doesn't matter if it's 100 sheep or 10 coins, if it's a third of your father's estate or all of your master's possessions, if you've been given it all like Dives or been given nothing at all like Lazarus. Whether it is time, possessions, or talents, God's desire is that you make the most of it, that you don't waste it, don't neglect it, don't squander it. Later on in Luke's Gospel in chapter 21, Jesus will be at the temple. And the text says, while he was at the temple, he watched the rich people dropping their gifts into the collection box. Then a poor widow came by and dropped in 2 small coins. "I tell you the truth," Jesus said, "this poor widow has given more than all the rest of them. For they have given tiny parts of their surplus, but she, poor as she is, has given everything that she has." Depending on your source here, the 2 coins could be worth 2 pennies or 2 loonies, but either way, that's not very much at all. And their value was not in their monetary amount, but their value was in how the widow used them, not their currency equivalent. She had made better use of her 2 small coins than the others had made use of great wealth. And that seems to be what is most commendable in Jesus' eyes. And that thought is at the same time both very freeing and very convicting. Because on the one hand, it means that I don't have to make some great gesture or fund some huge project or give some large amount. I don't have to feel guilty if I don't give up every free second of my time. If I don't have to feel insufficient if I don't bring the quantity or quality of skills to the table that I see other people bringing. Because it's not about how much I have. It's about what I do with what I have. On the other hand, it means even if I make a certain gesture or fund a certain project or give a certain amount, even if I put in a certain amount of time or contribute certain skills, it doesn't mean that I've necessarily done what God desires, because it's not about how much I have, It's about what I do with what I have. You see, the problem of the rich man in the story was not that he did particularly evil things, but rather that he did nothing. One commentator assesses the situation like this. Talking about the rich man, he says, he had not ordered Lazarus to be removed from his gate. He had made no objections to his receiving the bread flung away from his table. He did not kick him in the passing. He was not deliberately cruel to him. The sin of Dives was that he never noticed Lazarus, that he accepted him as part of the landscape and simply thought it perfectly natural and inevitable that Lazarus should lie in pain and hunger while he wallowed in luxury. Irish philosopher Edmund Burke has been well quoted as saying, "All that is necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing." And 1,700 years before Burke said that, James wrote a letter to the churches. And I wonder, as James wrote this section of text, if he had this particular story of the rich man and Lazarus in mind, or maybe a real-life example. And James writes to the churches, and he says, "What good is it, dear brothers and sisters, if you say, 'I have faith,' but don't show it by your actions? Can that kind of faith save anyone? Suppose you see a brother or sister who has no food or clothing, and you say, 'Goodbye, and have a good day, stay warm, and eat well.' But you do nothing to give that person any food or clothing. What good does that do?" So the question is, what are we going to do with what we've been given? Great or small, what will we do with it? Time or money or possessions or abilities, what will we do with it? Who is out there sitting at our gates, on the other side of our fence, in the cubicle next to us, at our favorite restaurant or coffee shop, at our school, our kids' school, or on our bowling team, or in our pottery class? Who's out there at Safeway or Walmart or the mall? Who needs us to make the most of what we have, to notice them, to help them, to love them, to accept them, to care for them, to reach out to them, to tell them that God hasn't given up on them, and to show them that we haven't given up on them either? The Apostle Paul writes to the church in Ephesus, and he says, "Be very careful then how you live, not as unwise, but as wise. Make the most of every opportunity in these evil days. Don't be foolish, but understand what the Lord wants you to do." Get Robert to come up and remind you again, next week Luke will be here, and he will be giving us our message out of Luke chapter 19, I believe.